Do not adjust your radio frequency. This is not a test. This is the Artist First Network.
Cool. Across every time zone, covering both hemispheres. It's another featured author special. We call it Authors First, and thanks for joining us, everyone. If you'd like to send a question or comment to our guest this hour, you can hit us up at dj@artistfirst.com. There is an icon provided at the top of the Artist First homepage, so you don't even have to address it. Just click on it and type in your question. Our guest tonight is a most fascinating individual. We have a lot to talk about this hour. Let me tell you about our guest a little bit. He was born in Michigan. He graduated from Mason County Central High School in Scottsville, Michigan, where he was awarded the Cox Award for Outstanding Student of Literature. He later attended both Texas A&M University and then graduated from Michigan State University with a BS degree in computer science and minors in English, creative writing, and political science. For 4 years, our guest worked as an intelligence analyst and programmer for the CIA in Langley, Virginia, where he was awarded an Exceptional Performance Award, the agency's highest honor, by the agency's director. After leaving the CIA, our guest moved back to Michigan, where he has resided and is currently residing for the past 11 years. And our guest also works for a large aerospace company as their director of information technology and lives with his wife and family on the western coast of Michigan. My pleasure to introduce and welcome Paul M. Strickler. Hi, Paul.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, I'm really happy and excited to be here. So I really appreciate the opportunity for having me on the show.
This is the reason the station was created, to feature folks just like you and get the word out for folks just like Paul M. Strickler. Paul, as is customary on Authors First broadcasts, we need to find out a little bit more about our guest before we get into your writing career. So tell us a little bit more about Paul M. Strickler.
Well, you hit a lot of it in the intro, so I've done a few interesting things, been a few different places. Glad to be back in Michigan, but I have spent some time in other parts of the country, like Texas and Virginia, and around the Washington, D.C. area when I worked for the CIA. So everybody always finds that kind of interesting.
Yeah, I do, especially being in that type of thing, and I can't resist. I'm going to have to ask you some questions about working for the... You're not going to have to kill me or something, are you?
Oh, no.
Okay, well, and you probably... Well, of course, the Echelon system's listening to everything we say anyway, but... I wonder how many people actually know about the Echelon system, but come on, let's talk about that right away. You don't run into that many people that work for the CIA.
No.
So, what was that whole experience like?
That was incredibly fascinating. So it was actually a college internship. So I went there and I worked what they call tours of duty. So I worked four different tours in between going to school. I worked in the Office of Scientific and Weapons Research. Which was kind of interesting, very, very technology focused department of the agency. In fact, the particular area I worked in, the people studied high energy lasers. So that was pretty fascinating.
Cool.
I got to did programming on a Cray supercomputer at the time, which was, one of the most powerful computer systems at the time. So it was just great experience. So,
were you? What's it like to be in that environment surrounded by, let's see, everybody's in the same room. They're all working for the CIA. They're all, we see things on television and then we hear a lot of things that don't necessarily jive with what we might see on TV.
Yeah.
Is it, compared to other places you've worked, what was it like being there?
I have to say it's probably been one of the most stressful jobs I've ever had, just because of the type of work you were doing. its importance, and that type of thing. And I have to say that the people I worked with there were probably some of the most hardest working, dedicated people I've ever worked with. So they really care about their country. They're trying to do a good job. And you know, the CIA gets a lot of negative press sometimes because, you know, the general public will hear about their missteps and stuff. But when they do things right, you generally don't hear about it. So that was one thing that was pretty eye opening for me.
Well, and just one more question on this before we move along. Do you think that the bad rap that the CIA and the intelligence community has received at the hands of this administration was justified, or did the administration ignore good intelligence from good intelligence analysts?
There's probably been some on both sides. Like I say, there's a lot of hardworking people. They put forth a lot of information. Sometimes it's hard to really weed out what is good information and what does our government need to act upon and what can it ignore. You know, it's a tough job to figure that out sometimes. So,
well, I don't buy it. I think it's a lie. I think it's another administration lie that this is the biggest intelligence failure in the history of our country. Bull crap.
Yeah,
we got morons running our country. That's the problem. But that's a whole nother program. Listeners, we're not going to talk about the CIA anymore because that's not what Paul does any longer. He is a novelist. He has out a brand new book called The Calling. You know, there's a lot of sixes in your phone number, too. I was thinking about that. Well, okay. And let's send people over to horrorplace.com, HORROR place.com. You can link through on our homepage. Nice website, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I guess it ought to be if you're good enough to do computer programming for the CIA, you better have a bomb website.
Yep, I did create it myself, so.
It makes ours look like the you know what it is. But, folks, surf on over horrorplace.com. Tell us about the book that we're going to be discussing for the next hour. It's titled The Calling.
Yep. The Calling, it's a horror thriller set in northern Michigan. It has a bit of a mystery element in it as well. So it's enough that I think it'll appeal to enthusiasts of both genres, both horror and mystery. All day today, in preparation for this interview, I was trying to think of a good one-liner to kind of capture the essence of the book. And I finally gave up. There was just too many elements in the book to really, really snapshot it like that. So I thought I would just read the synopsis that's on the back cover.
Good. That sounds great. Let's do
it. Okay. The Saracen family's moved to northern Michigan as meant as a getaway from the stressful big city life of suburban Detroit. Instead, they find themselves engaged in an epic struggle with a demon, their new house's sinister past, and with themselves. From a mysterious stranger who stalks them to a hotel clerk who describes her house's former owner as a doctor not of the living but of the dying, from sounds of digging and voices under their house to an enormous stone circle used for Satan worship in the forest behind them, from the discovery of journals describing demon calling to a sheriff who may be one of them, the Saracens are plunged into a seemingly unstoppable descent as pawns in a game where the future of the world depends upon their ability to stop the creation of an immense gate, a portal between the world of the living and that of the revengeful dead.
And that's The Calling, folks. It is available. It is out now. You can purchase the book. And in case someone can't stay to listen to this address later, let's tell them right now where they can get a copy of the book.
That's www.horrorplace.com. It's also available on Amazon.com. If you order direct from my website, you will get an author-signed copy and free shipping. So
there you go. Why not? Hey, I know, folks. Why not the author make some money on selling his own book? That's what a concept there. Okay, I know it's radical, but we and listeners, all seriousness, thank you for supporting the many fine authors that come through here. Now, you've actually been writing stuff that's poetry and articles that have been getting published clear back since the late 80s.
Yes. Yep.
So
yep.
At what point in your life did you realize that you had a talent for writing?
A talent? That's a good question, but I've always been interested in it because I've always been a big reader, and I'll attribute some of that to my mother who taught me to read at a pretty early age. And I was surrounded by readers in my family as well, so So I just kind of was brought up in that environment, and as soon as I was reading, I wanted to write. You know, I saw what others were doing, and I said, "Boy, you know, I'd really like to do that." So I've always had an interest in it, and played around with short stories and poetry and stuff, and finally, my passion, of course, was to write a novel. So about in the early 90s, I really started thinking about it and getting a little more serious. And then about 1994, I guess, is I decided that's really what I wanted to do. And so that's when I wrote this book. So it's been a long time in the making.
Well, some folks just, let's say, Frances Ray, I interviewed her last week. She's written 31 novels in the past 6 years. Or 7 years ago, and then there's folks that take a much longer. I don't know that there's any rule that says you have to write a book overnight. I mean, is this one of these things you'd work on a couple hours a month or whenever the spirit moved you?
Well, no, I actually got pretty serious about it, and I wrote the first draft in just 93 days. So I got it done in pretty quick order. And then from there, I started redrafting it. I got a lot of people to read it, get some of their comments, and then I started submitting it out. But I kept writing. So I've written three more novels since this one. None of those are published yet, and I haven't even tried to send any of them out yet.
Wow!
But I've kept writing all along. So it's getting a little bit easier. So.
Well, you originally first put out this book with a publisher, and then you decided that maybe that wasn't the best route to go?
Yes, yep. I originally went with a small publisher out of Wisconsin, and speaking of sixes, we released the book on 666 last year, so June 6th, to try to tie into the horror element there. And then actually not that much longer after that, I ended up leaving my publisher and going out on my own, and I did my own, got my own printer, and did a second edition. So
that's kind of gutsy. You got,
yes, it is,
and it's expensive.
Yes, it is. So
well, but that's hey, if you don't believe in your own product, you can't expect someone else to.
Yep.
And again, the rewards are much larger when you're doing it yourself. You get to actually keep the money. And with the new printing technologies that have come along in the last 10 years, it's much less expensive now to get a book published and quicker and easier, the whole nine yards. Did you find that part, getting the manuscript and into digital format and all that, was that a labor of love, or was that like pushing a boulder up a mountain?
Oh, no, that actually kind of enjoyed that. Formatting the file and getting it ready for the printer, working with the printer, proofing the copies and all that kind of stuff, even getting the an embossing die for the front cover kind of stuff was all. It was pretty interesting to actually see what all went into it to produce a book. So it was actually quite enjoyable. So
I'm making the prediction, Paul, that in the near future you will see a little kiosk inside your bookstores now that will be connected to the internet, that will be able to manufacture a print-on-demand book in a few minutes, so that what will happen is this will become the new, instead of having to stock books, if you want this book, go get a pretzel and come back, and your book is ready.
Yeah, that's definitely possible with today's technology. So.
Well, and what about other technologies that are seeming to come online today, such as audiobooks or the book as an ebook?
Yeah, the ebook thing, at least from what I've seen, really hasn't caught on. From what I've talked to people, there's just so many people just like the feel of that physical book in their hands, and that the turning of the paper pages. That ebooks have kind of flatlined from what I understand.
But. I would agree with you. And I cannot understand it, because you can make an ebook for about a quarter, 25 cents, and if less than the price of a postage stamp, you can deliver an ebook, far less. So I would have thought that the cost factor would drive the public to it. Hey, I can get a book for $3 instead of 90, but it hasn't. So for the reasons you probably stated, that it simply has not. However, the audiobook, industry seems to be flourishing, and especially with MP3 technology. We currently sell a 16-hour audio book for Riley Martin that fits on two MP3 CDs.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of these big 18, 19, 20 CD collections you have to buy.
Yeah.
You know, and the UPS man needs a two-wheel dolly to wheel it into your house when he delivers it. So I don't know, you know, and those, but of course those things require production time and that, but you know, as a person that you said you read all the time and you're a big reader, I can't help looking around me in this world and seeing that it seems to me, my perception here, is that there are fewer big readers now than there used to be.
I don't know about that.
Let me rephrase that statement. Because of the hectic, I have no time to read, like the plight of newspapers. Who has the time to sit down in the morning and read a newspaper? Come on. There's nothing wrong with the newspaper, but because of our lifestyles, I think a lot of people would read more if their lifestyles would allow it.
Yeah. Well, my wife has always been a big reader and remains so today. And we've got four kids we're trying to raise, but you know, she still makes the time and reads quite regularly. So.
Well, and you know, of course, we want as many people to have lifestyles that allow them for the pleasures and of the finer things in life. If you're tuning in late, you will not get a chocolate milk in this afternoon's recess. Paul M. Strickler is our guest tonight on Authors First. If you'd like to send a question or comment, hit us up at dj@artistfirst.com. So, Paul, why did you? What draws you to horror/mysteries?
Well, that started as a young teenager. I think it was my sister that first handed me a copy of a Stephen King book, and it was Salem's Lot. And you know, she said, "Here, read this. You might like this kind of a story." And you know, I never read horror up to that point, and so I took it and I read it and said, "Wow, this is pretty good." And a little bit later, I was at a yard sale, and I bought another title. This one was a Ghost Story by Peter Straub, and I read that. And pretty much after that, I was totally hooked. So I started reading all the big horror names, got into Dean Koontz, and read a lot of H.P. Lovecraft and all those kind of guys. And so, you know, that's what I wanted to write then. So
it's some pretty good company. I thought the folks, the book is called The Calling. It is a horror mystery, and I thought let's talk about the tree and the story behind the tree.
Okay.
And tell them about, and by the way, how do you pronounce the, is it Boyne City?
Boyne City.
Okay. Yep. Well, tell them about the story about the tree.
Well, I was going through the town of Boyne City one day, and I saw this tree that just struck me. You know, very oddly, because it was a pretty thick, heavy-looking kind of tree. It had these three big branches that came out, and the branches kind of curled around. And as soon as I saw it, I the image of a claw popped into my head, like this hand-like claw coming up out of the ground. And the image just kind of stuck with me all day. And that night, I went home, and I keep a journal too, so I'm a big journal writer. And so I started writing about this tree, and pretty soon this kind of story idea started to develop, and probably a couple hours later I had a full outline of about 35 chapters for this novel that ended up becoming The Calling. So it was kind of all inspired by this tree. So.
And then they cut it down.
And then they cut it down, yes, even before I got the book done. So it was,
dang, you know, well, it was a good thing.
Shortly thereafter. So
well, see,
wasn't even able to get a picture of it or anything. So
it served its purpose. It was,
yes, it did.
It took care of what it needed to take care of.
Yep.
The characters in your book. Let's talk about the Saracen family.
Okay.
You know, and every author has to come up with characters in their books. So who do you base yours on? Are they totally fictional, or is there any real people in there?
They're pretty much totally fictional. I'm sure there's probably, you know, little elements of different people that might have worked themselves into the characters, but you know, they're largely fictional. One of the things I did in preparation before even writing the first draft is I did some pretty extensive what I call character sketches for each of the major characters, and just kind of you know, developed who they were, and you know, anything from what their favorite color was to their favorite foods and movies they liked, and you know, got a really good feel for who these people were even before I started to write the story. So,
yeah, and how do you research something like a horror mystery?
Well, not a lot of research went into it because it is, you know, totally fiction. The only possible things I kind of researched, I did some research into religious cults because that plays part of the backstory of the book. Outside of that, there wasn't really a lot of hardcore research like you might do for a, you know, historical fiction type story or something like that. So,
well, it was interesting that you used your one of the homes you lived in as a teenager.
Yes, yes.
Now, that was in Michigan?
Yes, it's also in Michigan.
And it was an old Victorian home?
Yes, it's actually located in Scottville, Michigan. And, yeah, it's, I grew up there as a teenager. So I had it was a really neat house. It had a lot of character. It was a big house. So it made a perfect setting for the book.
Well, and it does, too, because, see, though, that's sort of, I don't know, if that's not really research, but it's reality. You know the nooks and crannies and the creeks,
yep.
And
yep.
It just makes for a better story. You know, when you sit down to write a mystery, do you know the ending of the book before you begin?
In this case, I did, because I fully outlined it out from the first chapter to the last. So I had the full story in mind before I even started writing that first paragraph. So.
You know, you'll hear this cliche in many of these types of interviews, what inspires you, but is it really this tree inspired you?
I guess. I don't know if it inspired me or it just kind of sparked a bunch of ideas, and I kept building on these ideas until I had developed this kind of a complex story. So,
is there a target reader that you might have in your mind, maybe an age group? I mean, obviously, you know, anybody that likes horror mysteries would be enjoying of this book. But is there, you write a little bit more towards for guys, for gals, or do you even maybe not even consider that?
Never even considered that. So it's written for anyone who likes Stephen King, Peter Straub, Dean Koontz, those kind of guys. This book is right along the same type of thing. So,
well, the title, of course, is critical to any book. How did you, without giving away any, you know, maybe something you don't want to reveal?
Yeah, that is kind of a bit of the plot.
Okay,
where that title comes from. So,
well, we can't go there. And how about the cover of the book? Maybe you could describe it to the folks that can't see it.
The cover is actually it's a piece of artwork that even that has a name that was created by Duncan Long. The name of it is Stranger at Hangman's Tree. It's a picture of this shadowy figure, kind of on a hillside, and you don't see the tree, but you see one of the big branches kind of overhanging this shadowy figure, who seems to be, you know, looking off into the distance. So it kind of plays into the plot of the course that the tree is kind of is a part of the story. But there's also this character who's called the Mysterious Stranger that makes an appearance early in the story and keeps kind of popping up along the way. And so,
is he looking at the cover now on your website? Does he seem to have a rope around his neck?
Yes, that's actually supposed to be like a broken hangman's
right.
Hangman's rope. So,
I should wear my glasses to work. God, I'm getting old. I can't see things anymore. Well, did you, you know, gee, now that you're printing this book yourself, obviously you didn't have to fight with some editor about what the cover would be.
Right.
Is this the same cover that was on when you were with the other publisher?
Yes, it is. There's slight little variations that, you know, kind of did a little different things with the title work and redesigned the spine and that kind of stuff. But the basic cover is yeah, what it looked like in the first edition, so.
Do you like to get into the marketing side of things. I mean, of course you have to, but I mean,
yeah.
Some people see it as pulling teeth. Other people jump into it with both feet. Are you a book signer? Do you like to go to the public appearances, speeches? What are you doing these days?
Yeah, I've been trying to do a lot of signings. In fact, I've got three events scheduled for this March coming up. I've done things like, I've done signings at a bookstore. I've done signings at craft shows. Last December, I was in a mall, kind of pick up on the holiday buying season, so that worked out pretty good. And you know, I've been doing all this myself, so it's been been a bit of a learning experience as well. But it's kind of been fun. I try to do a little bit of marketing each day, you know, whether it be an email to somebody or doing some searching for some events or that kind of stuff. So.
Well, we've heard every imaginable story, both good and bad, about independent authors out there trying to get some shelf space, trying to get a table space for a book signing. We've heard horror stories from employees of major chains of bookstores who tell us that major publishers threaten them to not allow shelf space to books that aren't of their liking. So what's your experience with having said all that? What has been your experience so far?
That's probably pretty close because I've had a pretty tough time getting my book into stores. So there's one notable exception. I might as well mention them on the air, and that's Horizon Books in Petoskey. Gave me a chance, and in fact, they hosted a signing for me, and they said it's been one of their best selling titles. So
bravo, excellent.
And I've used that information and followed up with several other Michigan stores and gotten no response. So it's been very puzzling.
Don't feel that it's you, because we hear this all the time.
Uh-huh.
It's don't take it personally. Do you tell them that you worked for the CIA?
That's a good angle to.
It should be your opening sentence. Former CIA analyst Paul M. Strickler would like to talk to you.
I'll try that.
Do you hear?
Sounds like a good opening. So.
The second sentence should be: do you hear clicks on your telephone? Well, you know, hey, whatever marketing angle you can use.
Yep.
Well, who knows? We are interviewing Paul M. Strickler, author of The Calling. You're listening to Authors First on the Artist First Radio Network. How do you develop your dialogue? Some authors walk around their houses and their neighbors think that they've gone lunatic because they're having conversations with themselves. But how do you work all that out?
That's a good question. I've seemed to have always, excuse me. I seem to have a pretty good knack for dialogue. I'm not really sure where it comes from or how I developed it.
All those eavesdropping days at the CIA.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it, yeah. So, but that's actually been a pretty easy part. I hear a lot of authors that struggle with dialogue. So for me, it just seems to come kind of natural. So not really sure how that's happened, but I'll take it.
That's right. If it's not broke, why fix it? We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a short pause for the cause. Folks are listening to Authors First. When we get back, Paul is going to read a couple passages from his book and answer any email questions you guys may wish to send in. We'll be right back. You're listening to Authors First on the Artist First Radio Network. Thank you. You're listening to Authors First on the Artists First World Radio Network. Scott Z in the host chair tonight. Paul M. Strickler, our author guest this evening. His book out called The Calling is a horror mystery. It's available at his website, which is horrorplace.com. It's linked up on our Artists First homepage. If you're listening to the archive, it should be alongside the archive link as well. Horrorplace.com. It's also available at Amazon.com. And where else did I leave out, Paul?
There's a bookstore in Petoskey, Michigan that's carrying it as well, which is Horizon Books.
And that's terrific. We like to plug any bookstores that help independent authors out there. Have you had any real bad experiences so far since you got into the novel writing business?
No, I can't say that I have. I've had a few interesting folks come up to me at different signings. I seem to get some of this. People ask, well, is it a religious book? Or because of the title, kind of has a bit of a religious connotation as well. And when I tell them it's horror, they kind of get this really, weird look on their face and walk away real fast. But that's not everybody. I mean, so
call security. But, yeah. Well, and then the guys that show up that have aluminum foil socks on, you just never. Well, they're the public. They're your buying public anyway.
Yeah, I did have one woman that came up to me that she'd read the book and was convinced that most of the events in there that I'd written about were based on true things that had happened. And I tried to convince her otherwise, but she seemed to think, no, this was all true and stuff. So.
and for the record, at least that's your story and you're sticking to it.
That's right.
Well, the publishing business and the independent author business, in my opinion, is flourishing. This is, I think, the dawning. The last several years, independent authors and self-published authors have really begun to come into their own. Many authors are doing well, actually making a profit from their book, which, let's face it, even though you want to make a profit from your book, is that the only reason you're doing this?
No, actually, that isn't even one of my goals, is to make a profit.
I didn't think it was.
I'd be happy if I broke even at this point. So
why do you do this then?
It's just been a desire and a goal since as long as I can remember to get a book out there to share a story with the world. It's just a unique feeling, I guess.
It is. When you first opened that box when UPS dropped it off and you got that first copy in your hand and there's your name on the bottom of it, what was that like?
Oh, that was an incredible day. Just a day I felt like I'd waited for my whole life. So indescribable. So.
How is it with many artists feel a little uncomfortable around family members? It's easier to perform maybe a song in front of a stranger than it is in front of your brother or something. Do you get that? Maybe that sounds odd to some people out there, but it's the truth. Do you let your family read your work as it goes? Do you surprise them at the end?
I don't let them read it as it goes, generally. I've kind of reserved the honor of reading first drafts for my wife. So she gets to read first drafts. In fact, she's got one on her desk right now. That I wrote, or just finished up here a couple weeks ago. So she's getting ready to read that. But then after I start doing some of the rewrites, I actually welcome, family members to read it and kind of critique it. That hasn't been a problem for me. So.
Well, every author is even in a way, even if they're not writing about themselves, they are revealing a portion of themselves.
Yes, they are. Yeah, it's... Yep, I agree with that.
For some people, that gets a little uncomfortable sometimes. Well, we've got three passages we want to read to you folks. Not we, actually. Paul's going to read them to you from the calling. And you want to set these up one at a time. So let's start with the first one.
The first one is, the way the book is arranged, it's arranged in four different parts. And each part has its own prologue. And the prologue acts as kind of flashbacks to some of the history that sets up the main story that the book details. So the first one I was going to read is Prologue 4, and just because it's basically one of the shortest ones. So let me just start that. Sylvia Wolfe was dying. The first bullet had struck her in the shoulder. The second had grazed her left side and broken a rib. The third had gone directly into her chest. Her black robe, soaked with blood, clung to her like some groping thing. She felt cold, as if the air was devouring the heat from her body, sucking the warmth from her like a vampire. She finally reached the hidden tunnel entrance and managed to slip inside unnoticed. The tunnel resembled a black tomb until she saw the light. It was a blue light, and she knew its source and let it guide her. Each time she faltered, the light came closer, warming and beckoning. She walked for what seemed hours before arriving at a small, dead-end cavern, perhaps 15 or 20 feet in diameter. When the last of her strength had drained, she fell to the dirt floor and closed her eyes. On the ground, she smelled musky dirt and blood and something else, like the odor of an animal long dead. Breathing heavily, she pulled herself into fetal position for warmth, keeping her eyes closed, even as she sensed the approach of the light. The light's caress upon the exposed skin of her face and arms was colder than anything she had ever felt before, and she wanted to cry out, yet the overpowering cold had paralyzed her muscles. She tried to move her legs, but the robe, now frozen stiff like a steel suit, restrained her. For a moment, her skin burned with the severity of the coldness, and then she felt nothing. Still, the intensity of the cold increased as the light grew nearer and brighter, now only able to be sensed through her permanently frozen eyelids. There was a sudden intense pain again, but only for a moment. Then it was gone, replaced by an excruciating feeling of exhaustion. She felt herself slipping away from the light, out of the tunnel, down into a bottomless darkness. It was the darkness, however, that welcomed her, comforted her, warmed her, and in time, it became her.
Wow, I'm there. See, there's your audio book right there, see? There it is. I very much enjoy listening to audiobooks in my van when I drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there. That's great. I want to get back to the question I asked you before about about research, because in a way you have to, you know, all the without giving away too much detail, but the mm-hmm. you know, the cults involved, the practices, the procedures, the things that they do, you know, that you have to have some awareness of those things to describe them, right?
Yeah.
So you know, where is that something that you've just picked up over the years?
Oh, a little bit. I did research into some of it just to kind of see what the activities were in some religious cults, and but in the end, I probably kind of just made it up for this particular one, because it had a kind of unique purpose to it. So, and again, I don't want to, you know, be a plot spoiler, so I won't go into much more than that. But,
I was hoping you wouldn't say I'm the grand poobah of the Michigan chapter.
No.
But, you know, it's those are the aspects that make the story fascinating. Why do you think the genre of horror has always done so well and probably always will do so well? People just like to get scared?
Yeah, they do. They like to see it happening to somebody else, because then they can feel that it's not happening to them. So that's kind of my theory, I guess.
What kind of things frighten you?
Oh gosh, it's funny, but just about everything, I should say. I'm easily scared. I don't know why that is. I've heard Stephen King is kind of the same way. He's scared of the dark and will leave a nightlight on and that kind of stuff. So maybe that's a characteristic of horror writers, that they have to be highly sensitive to being scared in order to be able to write what scares us all. So,
well, you're in that zone, so to speak. you know, if I'm sitting around a campfire, camping out, and we're talking about astrophysics, I'm not the least bit frightened. But if we're talking about headless horsemen and Bigfoot and stuff, all of a sudden every sound becomes, you know, amplified or something. So maybe because you live in that zone where those are the type of thoughts that you're contemplating your next chapter, your next character,
mm-hmm.
that you're just more acutely aware of the dangers and we're just oblivious to, I suppose.
Yeah. And I really like to explore what I call the horror of the ordinary. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, super terrifying monsters, but just, you know, little simple things like that little noise you hear in the basement and you kind of wonder, you know, what was that? You know, was that something I should check out, or is it, you know, has it always been there and I just never noticed it before, or is it something else, something new?
Do you ever have nightmares?
A lot of people ask me that, and I actually think I've only had one true nightmare in my life, but when I describe most of my what I call just my normal dreams, most people think of those as nightmares. So, and I do get a lot of imagery and stuff from dreams that I use in my writing. In fact, the calling makes use of a lot of dreams and stuff, and that's even one of the passages, if we've got time, that I'll read last is one of the dream sequences that's in the book.
Alrighty, but speaking of reading passages, let's move on to number two now.
Okay, this one's it might be a little bit of a plot spoiler. I hope not. It's taken from near the end. It's kind of it's chapter 64, but it's just got some an interesting interaction between kind of the antagonist and the protagonist in the story. So I thought it would be kind of good. Ah, yes. I feel your little mind working, Michael, searching and groping for answers like some insect, feeling along with its antenna for the slightest crumb of nourishment. To be honest, I find it amusing and yet so pathetic to think that a child could have even the faintest comprehension of the events unfolding before him, events anticipated, planned, and designed almost since time's beginning. Yes, I must say, amusing indeed. Is that what you wanted my sister for, as a vehicle to contain your form? No, Tufel, you're the only one deserving of pity here, Michael said. Tufel didn't merely chuckle this time, but emitted a gush of crazed laughter that seemed to rattle the entire cavern, gobbets of it bouncing from wall to wall, unaffected by the cavern's rhythmic booming, the laughter bursting and splattering over their heads in a shower of thick, vile sound. Oh, Michael, I find you so entirely entertaining. It'll be such a shame to destroy you with all the rest. You continue to insist on trying to break everything down into petty wants and desires, if for all nothing more than some individual agenda of self-gain. But it's so much more than that, my dear child, I'm afraid, Michael, that the grand events you so unwittingly fell into the middle of are quite beyond the limits of your tiny mind to imagine. Its sheer magnitude, incomprehensible for any human mind to grasp, let alone yours. Such an overwhelming display of confidence only proves you're still afraid, Tufel, Michael said, his mind racing to put the final pieces together. He felt so close. So what is it? What are you afraid of? Afraid I'm going to stop you? When the creature smiled, the sight of his grandfather's smiling, eyeless face was suddenly too much for him, and he turned aside. I see your friend has been most helpful to you. Pity it doesn't matter now. Somehow Michael found the courage to confront the horror before him once more. Come, come, Michael. Don't attempt to play the fool with me, even though ultimately that is what you are. Yes, your eyes betray the one I speak of, the one who calls himself Harvey Olds. I must admit, though, that I applaud his guardianship of the South Field Tunnel entrance. Most admirable, but I assure you even he cannot stop what is about to be unleashed now. Suddenly, the last piece of the puzzle clicked into place, and Michael's understanding became complete. Michael thought he finally knew what it was Tufel was up to, the essence of what he immediately thought of as Tufel's grand plan. It had come together so quickly and easily that he wondered why he hadn't realized it before. But with this revelation, there came additional doubt. But did I just figure this out on my own, or did someone show me? How could I know for sure? Does it make a difference? Suddenly I sense a certain degree of understanding in you, Michael. Perhaps I have misjudged you after all, if only just a little bit. You think you understand now, do you? You believe you sense the truth? You sense nothing. You know nothing. Even what you think you know is wrong. And whatever truth you feel you found is based on lies, based on misinformation, based on deception and deceit from those you naively call friends. You have been played a fool, Michael, used and led, for amusement, for entertainment, for selfish formulas you do not understand, cannot understand, and will never be allowed to understand. You're a puppet, Michael. Pity you do not see the strings. Though you cannot understand this either, I will tell you that I have not, nor will I ever deceive you. I have nothing to hide. I am not here to misguide you or let you founder with incomplete information. Here, let me show you. And I'll stop there.
Just thought I'd add some sound effects there. Studio audience. And if you're just joining us, folks, Paul M. Strickler is reading from his novel, The Calling. It's available everywhere, Amazon.com, or surf over to horrorplace.com. And we keep plugging away because people tune in and tune out throughout the hour. We don't want anyone to miss that information, Paul.
Yep.
Where do you see your writing career going over the next 10 years? This is obviously something you're going to be doing till you drop, I imagine, right?
I hope so.
You got three in the works now, and are you thinking of other ones past the three that are?
Oh yeah, I have quite a few ideas. So,
is there a book that you've always wanted to write that hasn't been one of these four yet?
Yes, there is. There's kind of probably my most ambitious project, and then even look at it as probably a multi-volume effort, and I don't know if I'll ever have the courage to try it, but yeah, there's definitely one like that out there.
Well, you know, I think it's a testament to your abilities to get a book done. How many people listening tonight got one in the drawer, always wanted to do it, come up with a million excuses why they haven't done it? And yet you have, and you have three more on the shelf, so to speak, and a bunch more in you. Well, let's get to the third section in case we get close on time. There is a third segment of the book that Paul would like to read. Let's do that now.
Yeah, this is even probably the longest one here. Dreams play a fairly pivotal role in the story, so I thought I'd share one of them. This is the second dream of Michael, who's the main character and who you heard in the last passage. But this is his second dream sequence. In the dream, he is outside, standing alone in the backyard. It is evening. He stares at the path leading into the woods, and then he is walking on it. Ahead of him, he hears voices, the sound of people chanting. He walks forward, and the evening becomes blacker, and the chanting gets louder. Within moments, it is pitch dark, and with the darkness, the air has become cold, and so he hugs himself and walks faster. Above the trees ahead, he can see an orange glow and smell smoke. Without transition, he is abruptly there, at the edge of the stone circle. A fire burns in its center, flames rising well over a dozen feet into the air. The fire, though, makes no noise. Then the chanting stops, and there is no one there, until the dancing orange light reveals the bodies in the trees. From every tree around the stone circle, bodies hang, held aloft by the branches they have been impaled upon. Black, thorn-like branches protrude from chests, necks, and heads like toothpicks through holiday gumdrops. The only sound is the blood raining upon the dead leaves of the forest floor. As he watches, the great boulders of the circle begin to bleed, the coursing blood starting as a small rivulet, seeping from a deep pore or crack, then building into a steady, pulsing stream. He notices the palpitating rhythm of the boulder nearest him, like a granite heart pumping blood. The blood forms into pools, and he realizes he is standing in one of them. He cannot move even though he wants to. The liquid soaks through his shoes and into his socks, and the blood feels warm, and he realizes he has stopped shivering. As the pools continue to grow, they send tentacles of blood toward the center of the circle and the base of the huge bonfire. Like spokes on a wheel, the blood flows from the rocks directly into the bonfire, turning the color of its flame from orange to ruby red, whose light then paints the hanging bodies with a red so dark they appear nearly black. He is now walking farther into the circle, his feet sinking into the blood-muddied ground. He approaches the silent fire but feels no heat and begins to shiver again. Rather than heat, it seems the fire is emanating waves of bitter, undulating cold. As he feels the warmth draining from his body, his shivering becomes uncontrollable. For relief, he plunges his hand into the flames, but immediately snatches it back. The biting coldness burns, and his aching hand turns black and shriveled with frostbite. Without warning, the sound of the blood rain stops, and in the trees he hears the bodies murmur. Then he is within the fire itself. The cold is intense, with a severity beyond description or endurance, like being plunged into the water of an ice-covered lake, and the pain multiplied 1,000 times. He screams, but there's no sound as he watches the bodies in the trees fall from the branches like a gruesome autumn harvest, striking the ground with heavy, wet sounds. As the bodies collect on the ground, they begin to writhe and twist. Back within the silent fire, he can no longer hear the murmuring voices, and for this he is thankful. The bodies continue to fall. The only sound the thud as they repetitively strike the blood-soaked ground, like a dozen irregularly beating hearts heard simultaneously through a dozen stethoscopes. They fall by the hundreds, and some of them land on the bleeding boulders. He winces at the sound of skulls cracking atop granite, the sound adding a staccato beat to that of the hearts. The fallen bodies rise on the ground, snaking and sliding their way across the sticky, wet mud toward the fire and ultimately toward him. The first body quickly approaches the fire, and its appearance is vividly illuminated by the red glow. The body is blackened like his hand and slick with blood and mud. As the body snakes itself closer, it extends a blackened arm toward the pulsing fire. Then his fingers, which are now only stumps, reach without hesitation into the flame. Michael hears a scream, and the body shrivels into an empty black husk. With the shriveling of the body, he is subsequently infused with renewed energy and strength. As the other bodies approach the fire, the ritual is repeated again and again. And like before, as each scream is uttered, he feels yet another rush of energy while the fire burns ever brighter and higher. Intoxicated with the power and strength of 100 people, he feels strong enough to pick up one of the car-sized boulders and toss it like a basketball. Feeling he is about to explode with power, he searches for release. Then he realizes he is no longer standing in the fire. Instead, the fire has become him, feeding itself from the power contained within him. Now when he moves, the fire moves with him. He walks to the nearest boulder, and it instantly shatters at his touch. But as he continues to burn, the fire drains him, consuming the energy he has previously received from the dead. Time is running short, and anxiety courses through him, an anxiety to do something with his power before it all drains away, but he doesn't know exactly what or how. The anxiety turns to panic as he begins to feel the energy draining from him faster and faster. However, he can do nothing but tolerate this strange sensation, making him feel as if his own blood is running out of his veins and arteries and fanning out across the ground like that from the boulders. In frustration, he runs from the circle and onto the path which leads back to the house. As he runs, burning through the forest, he sets trees and bushes on fire with green-colored flames. Within only seconds, it seems, he reaches his house and realizes he is no longer burning. The mysterious energy is also gone, drained from his body. Looking back at the burning forest, he feels sadness at having caused such a disaster. Soon, however, his feeling of helplessness returns as the forest burns and the flames light the sky like the glow of a city. The flames make no smoke and burn rhythmically with colors that cycle among green, red, and blue. The forest burns quickly, rapidly turning thousands of trees into ash. But then, as the flames fade and die, so too does the scene around him. Then, from within the darkness, a familiar voice speaks to him once again, though this time as if from a great distance. "You should check it out, boy. Check it out real good." The voice keeps repeating the phrase over and over before it ultimately dissolves into the darkness, fading and evaporating like the dream itself.
Paul M. Strickler reading from his horror mystery novel, The Calling, on tonight's Author's First program. Hey, I should have given you some applause there. There we go. All right. The studio audience liked that too. Yeah, boy, I get right into it right away too. You know, I guess it just falls. I'm there. You have a nice writing style. It's the type of style I like to read. Well, we just wish you the best of luck with this book. It's been out since 6606. That was a deliberate.
Yep.
That makes sense. And there are at least six sixes in Paul's phone number, but I'm not going to give that out on the air. Actually, there are seven, but that means that there's six as well, right? Well, Paul, where do you? What's happening in your immediate future? You have some events coming up. Perhaps some folks can stop in and say hello to you.
Yes, I have a few events coming up. March 9th, 10th, and 11th, I'll be in Midland at the Midland Mall. And then the following weekend, March 17th, I'll be in Royal Oak. And at the end of the month, I'll be in Davison, Michigan. So there's a complete event calendar on my website, so people can just click that link and see all the events I currently have scheduled.
And folks, it's linked up on the Artist First homepage, but for those of you too lazy to surf back over, just type in horrorplace.com. Horrorplace.com, that is the official website of horror author Paul M. Strickler, our guest tonight on Authors First. Paul, we're just down to about our last couple of moments here. Anyone you'd like to say hello to or insult in front of thousands of people?
Yeah. Well, I'll just say hello to all the listeners. I think there's probably a lot of friends and family out there listening to me tonight. So thanks for listening in. Thanks, Scott, too. So thanks to you and the other volunteers that make this media available for artists and authors like myself. So this is a really wonderful concept you have here, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Well, sounds like you got at least three more reasons to come back, as you were telling us about, as those books get published. We'd love to have you back. We're here to help folks just like you. That's the whole concept behind Artist First and Authors First, is to, hey, let's put the author first for a change. What a radical notion. Well, that wraps up this edition of Authors First. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. And listeners, thank you again for supporting the many fine authors that come through here by purchasing their products. And when you can, buy it directly from the author instead of a publishing house. The author makes a few more bucks, and what's wrong with that? We say nothing. Well, Paul, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight, and I hope it's real soon that you come back to visit us.
All right. Thanks again. So I'd love to come back.
Well, best of luck with everything. Anything we can do to help you out, Paul, our station is at your disposal.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us, everyone. Stay tuned. Spirit Teaching starts at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Artist First Radio Network.